This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Leia Fetter. Poland is a nation haunted by its 20th century.
Poland, September 1939. The German foe begins its ruthless march of conquest and sets the stage for World War II. Poland's 34 million inhabitants, crushed, scattered, and enslaved. Tens of thousands of square miles of territory shrink before the movement of lightning-armored columns. Poland and the world learn the meaning of a grim new word, Blitzkrieg.
Germany and the Soviet Union each invaded and occupied Poland during World War II, killing in the process some 5.6 million Poles, including 3 million Polish Jews. After the war, Poland became an independent republic within the Soviet bloc under communist rule. In 1989, it was one of the first of the Eastern European nations to break away and become a democracy. For decades, the nation has wrestled with the complicated question of how to interpret its own history. And so, in 1998, Poland founded its Institute of National Remembrance, whose motto is, "Our history creates our identity."
The Institute for National Remembrance was initially a place where historians could pursue questions that other historians weren't pursuing.
Janine Holk is a professor of political science at Loyola University, Maryland, where her focus is Eastern Europe.
Some of these questions involved, for example, Stalinist crimes in Poland. So there was a lot of attention being given to the Holocaust and crimes against Jews. And here was a place where they could pursue questions about crimes by the Soviet Union and the Soviet Union's representatives against Poland. So it was a place where history was being done consciously with a sense of, can we fill in gaps? Can we find archival sources and collect archival sources that other historians aren't doing?
But within a few years of its founding, the question of what history exactly needed to be examined became a bit more complicated, with the 2001 publication of a book called Neighbors by then NYU professor Jan Gross. Neighbors told the story of the 1941 Jedwabne massacre, in which hundreds of Polish Jews were massacred by their Polish neighbors in a fashion too gruesome to repeat on this program. And it set into motion a national reckoning. President Aleksander Kwaśniewski in 2001.
We can have no doubt that here in Jedwabne, Polish citizens were killed at the hands of fellow citizens.
He continued, "For this crime, we should beg for forgiveness from the souls of the dead and their families. This is why today, as both a citizen and president of the Republic of Poland, I apologize." For some other Poles, it was too bitter a pill to swallow. These citizens chose to see their nation as solely a victim of Nazi atrocities. Law and Justice, then a nascent right-wing party of the anti-communist right, took a stand against what it called the politics of shame. Party leader Jarosław Kaczyński's position has never wavered.
This whole pedagogy of shame, this push to accept guilt, has led to a situation where our nation has to face the unthinkable. I mean, our nation has to fight to stop accusations that we are guilty of the horrors of World War II.
At the time, Jarosław's brother Lech Kaczyński, the Law and Justice leader who would later serve as president and then perish in the Smolensk crash, was mayor of Warsaw, where he led the construction of a world-renowned museum that offered a more valiant story of Polish resistance. It's called the Warsaw Rising Museum, named for the 63-day military operation started in the summer of 1944, in which the Polish Home Army fought to wrest control of Warsaw from the Nazis. With no outside assistance, the Poles were defeated. 200,000 people died.
Germans bombed and shelled sections held by the Poles and finally were able to move tanks and heavy equipment into the recaptured city. The two-month-long revolt was a bloody and heroic battle, and starving Poles stripped dead horses for food. Forced to capitulate when no help came, The Poles signed an armistice with the Nazis.
When the museum opened, Paweł Machcewicz was working at the Institute of National Remembrance, which had dutifully investigated the Jedwabne massacre. To him, the Warsaw Rising Museum revealed some of the tensions to come.
It was only about the glory, the heroism, and not so much about the political and especially human price that was paid for this heroism. 200,000 people were killed during the uprising, and the great majority of them civilians. For me, it was one of the greatest tragedies in the Polish history, and we should, of course, commemorate this event, but I think that our obligation is also to discuss the price that was paid for this heroism and also all the political context, why the decision to start the uprising was taken. Was it a wise decision? Was it a huge mistake, perhaps? All that was ignored in this exhibition. It was the first exemplification of the politics of history of law and justice, not yet on the national level, but on the level of Warsaw, on the level of the capital of Poland.
He favored a more nuanced view of Poland's World War II experience, and in 2007 published an article in the liberal daily paper Gazeta Wyborcza, proposing another museum, one that would be built in Gdansk and tell the overall narrative about the Second World War.
A very broad picture of the past, not hiding sensitive parts of our history, and also the museum should somehow provoke visitors to think, to have their own reflection upon the past. My idea was that we should, of course, present the Polish history, but also the history of other nations who suffered in the war, who fought in the war.
And that idea got some serious pushback.
I thought, and I still think, that the best way to make people from abroad understand our history is to present this history against a broader background, and only against this broader international background, the specific features of a Polish history could be understood.
To leaders on the right, this dismissal of Polish exceptionalism was an attempt to destroy the nation in service of a foreign agenda. The intended museum's decision to focus more on civilians than the military was also denounced.
The Second World War was different from all previous conflicts because it affected mostly the civilians. And in the Polish case, it was even more striking because 90% of Polish citizens who died in the war were civilians. This approach was also rejected. It was labeled as pacifistic, as somehow denigrating the achievements of the Polish soldiers. And this criticism of this concept and later on of our exhibition that we created in Gdańsk was focusing on this allegedly too humanistic, too pacifistic and anti-war approach of our exhibition.
And yet, despite all this, the museum moved forward. The design was singular, a green landscaped plaza surrounding a bright red complex that featured a 40-meter tipped tower rising to the sky, representing the future and housing the museum's educational facilities. The permanent exhibition itself, all 50,000 square feet of it, would be underground, below the complex, a nod to the ways in which history forms the foundation of our world, below the surface. The experience of the museum was to feel both enlightened and entombed, ringed by tall walls of concrete and pulled in by video, touchscreens, wall text, and original artifacts, through which the museum sought to convey both civilian suffering and resistance, and drawing parallels across time and place.
We have a huge section of the exhibition devoted to the occupation of Europe and of Asia by Germany, by the Soviet Union, by Japan. We have also a huge section of the exhibition devoted to the Holocaust, and this is about not only what happened in Poland, but about many other nations. Our approach was that we tried to include as much as possible about Poland and Eastern Europe within the exhibition, but we tried to make it in a consistent way a part of a broader story. So every visitor would notice that Poland is present, in fact, everywhere in this exhibition, but always in connection with other nations with other cases of terror, of extermination, of resistance.
Several years and tens of millions of dollars later, it was almost ready. But in 2015, Law and Justice won the national elections. Makhtsevich and his team were just months from the opening when in April 2016, word came down from the central government that the museum would be liquidated and merged with the Museum of Westerplatz and the War of 1939, a museum in Gdansk that had not yet been built.
The museum did not employ a single employee, but did not have an address, did not have even a telephone number. And on this Friday night, it was announced that the biggest historical museum in Poland, the Museum of the Second World War, which was almost ready to be open to the public, would simply disappear, swallowed by a fictional ghost museum.
Makhtsevich had the multi-year contract guaranteed to all museum directors in Poland. Firing him outright would have been illegal. The so-called merger was a ruse. But since there was a legally mandated 3-month waiting period before any liquidations or mergers, Makhtsevich worked to speed up construction and shore up his base.
Despite all the obstacles created by the government, we worked in an incredible pace, trying to speed up everything. And at the same time, we were attacked by the law and justice propaganda, by the law and justice politicians, and we were accused of being not real Poles, of acting on the orders of Berlin or Brussels.
Makhtsevich was accused of financial irregularities. Jarosław Kaczyński declared on TV that the museum was not a Polish museum, but one imposed by Germany upon Poland.
The World War II Museum in Gdańsk, a sort of gift to Angela Merkel from Donald Tusk, is nothing more than an endorsement of Germany's politics of history.
In the meantime, protesters came out to show their support for Makhtsevich, and he and his team mounted legal challenges. In late March 2017, the museum opened. But only 2 weeks later, a letter came down from the Supreme Administrative Court giving the Minister of Culture full license to do with it what it wanted.
The museum was eventually liquidated. I was not even fired because simply the museum whose director I was ceased to exist. The Minister of Culture on the same day founded the new museum of the Second World War, but the name was the same. But legally, it was a new institution of culture. So the new director was nominated. On the first day in office, he declared that the exhibition would be changed.
At the time, Agnieszka Syroka was training as a tour guide at the museum. She and dozens of other guides had been preparing for months. But when the management changed, the guides were presented with a choice. Sign a document stating that they would follow the museum's new script, no editorializing, or leave.
You either sign it or no. And those who did sign could, you know, follow the path.
Why did you refuse to sign?
Along with the historical facts that you can read from the label, being a guide is also my opinion and my attitude and myself in this. And I didn't want to be forced to change the history.
And when you refused to sign, what happened?
So the moment you don't sign, you didn't get the proper ID to enter the exhibition. Yeah, you know, there are guards at the entrance. So we were informed that these guides who are not approved by the new management won't have the IDs to enter. So if you want to enter, you have to buy yourself a ticket.
About 2/3 of the guides refused to sign. And about 6 months after taking over, the new management began instituting changes to the exhibitions. Agnieszka says the changes in the museum's narrative have been hard to watch.
You know, there was a balance in this museum. There were good Poles and bad Poles. Now, in the museum, there are only good Poles.
There were almost 20 new elements introduced, or some elements of the exhibition that were removed.
Paweł Makhtsevich.
All these changes implement a certain vision of the history, and they go in two directions. One about removing these parts of the exhibition which are regarded as too international, and the second, adding new elements. A new installation was added about Poles saving Jews, and it suggests that Poles saved over 100,000 Jews, and historians know that this is a false number because not more than 30,000 to 50,000 Jews even survived the German occupation in the occupied Poland. The most invasive, the most aggressive change, this is removing of the film that was presented in the last room of the exhibition. It was a sort of a footage of archival films and archival photographs about wars, conflicts, violence that happened after the end of the Second World War until nowadays.
Czy w Polsce są żydowscy nacjonaliści? Towarzysze, na pewno tak odpowiadam.
The film begins with news of the end of the Nuremberg trials, followed by an announcement about Stalin, and then by globe-spanning shots from the Korean War, East Berlin, the UK, Turkey, from Martin Luther King and Occupy Wall Street. The final scenes depict the wars in Ukraine and Syria, and refugees.
This film was criticized by the right wing as too pacifistic, anti-war, and the new director of a museum declared that the museum should somehow encourage Poles to defend their country instead of presenting the war as a great tragedy.
The film that replaced it has a different tone.
Nobody thought the war and its effects would last half a century for Poland. First, Germany attacks. Then Soviet Russia. We don't give up, despite being left on our own.
It continues in this vein until its rousing end.
Worker strikes spread throughout Poland. The communists lose. The Iron Curtain falls. The war is over. We prevail. Because we do not beg for freedom, we fight for it.
It's not strictly a lie. It's Poland's story through a tightly focused lens, seen today in the World War II Museum in Gdansk, open to the public under the leadership of the Law and Justice Party, leadership from which we unsuccessfully sought comment many times. Meanwhile, Poland's culture war moved on to another institution.
Poland, the Warsaw Museum for the History of Polish Jews, is currently looking for a new director. The culture minister has a say in who will get the job, and he's looking for someone who wants to improve on, as he calls it, historical policy.
For a year, Poland's museum director, Dariusz Stola, sat in limbo. After his first five-year term as director, an independent committee asked him to stay on for another five. But to make it official, his appointment would have to be approved by the country's Minister of Culture, Piotr Gliński. Gliński didn't do it, nor did he explain why. But there are theories. In 2018, the Polish government passed an amendment related to history.
Poland's new Holocaust speech law. It was passed this year and it bans any claims that the country collaborated with Nazi Germany during World War II. Specifically, the legislation prohibits references to wartime Nazi death camps in the country as being Polish. Those in violation of that law face up to 3 years behind bars.
After outcry from the international community, the amendment was tempered. The law demoted from a criminal to a civil offense, with violators no longer risking jail time. Dariusz Stola was among those who criticized the law.
This is not a problem that should be given to the public prosecutor, but rather to educators. That the proper answer to ignorance is education.
So that's one theory for why Stola's appointment was never confirmed. Here's another. In March 2018, Poland hosted an exhibit called Estranged, looking at the March 1968 anti-Semitic campaign to purge Poland of its Jews once and for all, during which roughly 13,000 Jews were driven out. In the exhibit featured on the Poland website, friends wander through an exhibit and are disappeared one by one, while the anti-Semitic words of Władysław Gomułka, the communist leader of Poland from 1956 to 1970, drone in the background. The exhibit ends at a wall of anti-Semitic quotes from 1968 and 2018, at least two of which belong to members of the Law and Justice Party. Paweł Machcewicz.
The law does not say how much time the Minister of Culture has got to sign the contract, because it seemed quite obvious to everyone when this law was adopted that it should happen without any delay.
This February, Stola formally stepped aside, allowing the interim director to stay on for another 3 years. In a statement, the new director vowed to follow the course that Stolla had mapped out for the museum. Monuments and museums, especially those that trace a nation's past as a story, are often prey to political argument. Call it a testament to their continued relevance. Especially the increasingly popular narrative museums that array artifacts, photographs, and installations to illuminate or to mislead. In Nagasaki, Japan, there's the Atomic Bomb Museum, where in 1996, material about the Japanese Army's 1937 murder of 250,000 Chinese war prisoners and civilians was removed. In Budapest, Hungary, there's the House of Terror, built to show parallels and continuity between Nazis and Hungarian fascists and the communists. But the museum dedicates only a fifth of its content to the war, despite the 500,000 Hungarian Jews murdered during the Holocaust, and makes no mention of Hungarian cooperation with the Nazis in sending Jews to Auschwitz. Moszkiewicz finds Poland's use of state-funded museums to retell history deeply worrying.
4 years ago, I believed that I lived in a democratic country, which is a part of the European Union, which is in the heart of Europe. I, of course, knew that the confrontation between historians and politicians could be difficult sometimes, but I could not foresee that my country would somehow slide into a sort of a hybrid regime, which is not anymore the liberal democracy, which is somehow moving towards a certain form of authoritarian regime, and that history and especially historical museums would be in the core of all the controversies, and that my life as a historian and as a citizen would almost overnight turn upside down, and that defending the autonomy of history, autonomy of the culture, which was something elementary, basic to me, would become quite a tough issue, which would be connected to a price that you have to pay for it.
And thus, the Institute of National Remembrance, where Moszkiewicz got his start and which was created to expose and examine the most uncomfortable parts of Poland's past, is now the cudgel of the Law and Justice Party, policing debates about Polish culpability and quashing party critics. Janine Holk.
As this nationalist government came to power, this institute began to, first of all, downplay any historical projects that the government did not support and amplify its role not only in publishing historical work, but then actually creating policy based on that historical work. So they were crucial in creating a policy in which citizens could look up other citizens' secret police files. The Institute for National Remembrance set up a process by which the government could identify individual citizens and then expose any of the files the secret police had on them, accusing them of being an informant, including dates and including people who they were accused of informing against. And this was an incredibly powerful tool because it could be used to delegitimize their political opponents, and they indeed used it for that.
As Law and Justice uses state institutions to censor and suppress, it nudges the country ever further from the tenets of pluralism and democracy.
This political party became very emboldened by the numbers of votes it was getting in the elections and the types of support it was seeing for its rhetoric. And from that emboldened stance, it has pursued a number of increasingly authoritarian policies. One of these is cracking down on academic freedom. Another one is cracking down on LGBT rights. And another one is being much more assertive about museums and public spaces in Poland and what they can and cannot show.
But with Poland no longer under existential threat from Germany or the Soviet Union, how does it sell its defensive nationalist posture? Anne Applebaum.
What they've tried to do is create threats. One of the threats they created famously was this threat of Syrian refugees. Far-right magazines put pictures of the refugees on the cover and sort of Muslims murdering Christians. And so I would say it had some effect in Poland, but it didn't last very long, partly because there aren't any refugees in Poland and there aren't really any who want to get in there. How long can you go on about a non-existent threat? The second thing they tried, which appears to have been more successful, was an argument that Poland is threatened by gay ideology coming from the West. They called LGBT, which actually makes it sound weird. I mean, people don't even know what LGBT stands for. That's an English acronym. But they use it in Polish, and it sounds like a weird disease from the West.
Law and Justice is using its control of Poland's historical narrative to shape its current and future one. The present story? One in which Poland stands apart from other nations, unique in the existential threats it faces. Threats the party believes exempt it from Europe's shared commitment to human rights. But obviously, Poland is not unique. Many nations claim similar hardships as they pursue similar paths. And not just in Europe. The lessons of Poland are relevant oceans away.
After the break, OTM producer Leia Fetter updates her story on how Poland's far right seized control of the historical narrative to fuel its rise. Coming up, what Poland's presidential election last month portends for the future of a pluralistic democracy. This is On the Media.